Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
Last week in Provo, there was the first major court hearing in the case against Tyler Robinson. He's accused of killing the conservative activist Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University last September. Now, this was a preliminary hearing. It wasn't a trial. And these things usually don't take that long. The judge just has to decide whether there's enough evidence for the case to move forward. This hearing stretched out for 5 days, and it did give us our clearest look yet at the case that prosecutors are building and some early indications of the defense. Online, though, there's not much patience for a laborious legal process. Almost as soon as the shooting happened, elaborate conspiracy theories began to spread. One claimed the fatal shot didn't come from a rifle. It was an explosive device hidden in Kirk's microphone. Others are elaborating on how the shooting was somehow staged. Michael Shermer says, for most of these people, logic just isn't enough to conquer the human brain. Shermer is a science writer. He's founder of Skeptic magazine, and he's written about the conspiracy theories in the Kirk case for the online outlet The Free Press. He says they're not exactly new. They follow a pattern that psychologists have been studying for decades. It's a pattern rooted in cognitive dissonance. Shermer says the idea was first described by the psychologist Leon Festinger. In 1954, Festinger heard about this small cult called the Seekers. They believed the world would end on December 21st. They were convinced a catastrophic flood would destroy much of the Earth, but a flying saucer would arrive just in time to rescue the true believers. So Festinger and his colleagues joined the Seekers on the 21st.
Anyway, he thought, well, this will be interesting to go study this to see what happens when the world doesn't end. Of course, he's assuming that the world's not going to end. You never know. That could be the right one, but they really believe. So this is not just some play acting. We have a pretty rich history of people predicting the end of the world. Even just the secular versions, like the Y2K scare in 1999. You know, there was much brouhaha about this is going to happen. You know, planes are going to fall from the sky and ERs and hospitals are going to shut off and no one will know what to do. And nothing happened. So Festinger went there to study what happens when the doomsday doesn't happen. They're there with their clipboards, and predictably, nothing happens. First day, got a little distressed, like, well, it's 12 o'clock, and the mothership was supposed to come and rescue us and take us away from the big flood. That's going to happen any moment now. And the flood didn't come, the mothership didn't come, and they're checking their watches, and maybe it was Pacific time, not Mountain, Central time. And so the next day, they all just go home and disperse, and instead of just going about their lives, they double down on their beliefs. They recruited more people to join the group, and were insisting that they were right, but that they had miscalculated the date, or, the world did end spiritually, but not physically. And in other words, they had a list of rationalizations to justify their beliefs. Festinger called this cognitive dissonance. That is to say, what happens when you have a big important belief and it's not matched by the evidence? So it produces dissonance. And so you have to reduce the dissonance. You either say, well, I was wrong, which doesn't feel good, or you say, well, I was right, but, and then you have your rationalizations. The date was miscalculated or whatever. Most people in this process of cognitive dissonance, they just rationalize why they were right in the first place, but it just didn't come out the way they thought it was going to. And this is true across the board. We all do this. We practice cognitive dissonance. We rationalize things. It explains a lot about human behavior.
As you write in your article, the simplest explanation is also the hardest for many people to accept. I guess this is the idea that you're seeing as this trial for Tyler Robinson gets underway.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, it's behind most conspiracy theories, because conspiracy theories are usually about big, powerful, famous people or events, things that are influential, things that grab our attention. You know, so the assassination of JFK or the death of Princess Di or any of the rockers that have died, they all have conspiracy theories about them. You know, and now Lindsey Graham already. There's conspiracy theories that he was killed by the Russians, you know, poison tip dart or polonium traces in his food or whatever. No, he just died of a cardiovascular disease in this torn aorta. You know, that's very common, but people don't want to believe that because it's somebody big and famous. If it was a nobody, like John Ritter, the actor, died of the same thing. But he's just an actor, whatever, not that famous. So there were no conspiracy theories about him, but there are about Lindsey Graham. So the bigger the event, the more influential, the more famous, the more it grabs your attention, the more people think, well, there has to be something else behind it rather than the mundane.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we're going to look at what was revealed in the hearing last week, but we're also going to spend some time with this conspiracy part. Michael Shermer is the host of the podcast, The Michael Shermer Show. His recent article for the Free Press is called Why the Charlie Kirk Conspiracy Theories Will Never Die.
The preliminary hearing, that was unusual because it was so long. It was almost like they wanted to pretend it was the trial, and people actually confused that. I could read on social media and even in the mainstream media, oh, the trial today. It's like there was no trial. This is a preliminary hearing.
Yeah.
Usually these take like a few minutes, an hour or two or a couple hours at most, not 5 days. If it was not Charlie Kirk, if it was just some nobody that died, you know, there's over 40,000 gun deaths, and I think it's about 30,000 homicides per year in the United States. I mean, they happen all the time. Yeah. They happen hundreds of times a day. But nobody cares about them because most of the victims are not famous. But Charlie Kirk was famous, and he was influential. So, you know, when somebody shoots him, now all the focus is going to be behind who really did it, right? So That's a form of cognitive dissonance, this proportionality bias. Somebody big and famous must have a big and famous or big and elaborate cause. So the effect should be matched by the cause. Mm. All that is an attempt to kind of balance the scales of cosmic justice in your mind. Big effects must have big causes.
So in the piece, you go through some of the conspiracy theories related to Charlie Kirk's murder. And I wanted to go through some of these, have you take us through them, what you're seeing there. Let's start with the theory that Charlie Kirk was killed by Israel's national intelligence agency, Mossad. In particular, I guess the Jews more broadly. Explain this one. What's the thread of logic here, thin as it may be? What's going on?
The U.S. support of Israel has always been a hot button issue in American politics. Charlie Kirk was initially supportive of it, and then maybe he was slightly critical of it. And then you had big, famous public commentators like Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens pointing out, you know, like he said this, then he said that, or we're doing this, and he said that. Whatever somebody big and famous like Charlie Kirk or Tucker Carlson or Candace Owens says something, everybody tries to dissect it. And so they go through it. And so, for most conspiracy theories, there's usually some tiny little element of truth. In the case of Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, you know, they do assassinate people. They do conduct surreptitious raids and intelligence activities and so on. All intelligence agencies do that. Mossad does it, but they do it really well. The fact that they have done it doesn't mean they do it whenever anybody criticizes Israel. But that's the argument, you know, that Charlie had turned against the United States supporting Israel.
What are you noticing about Candace Owens in particular? You mentioned her. She's the right-wing commentator, media personality. I think most people listening know who she is. She called Tyler Robinson a patsy. She mm-hmm. said she didn't even think he was on campus, which sort of gets us to what I'm guessing is your takeaway from this preliminary hearing last week, which is there was overwhelming evidence that suggests, in fact, he was. So what are you seeing with what Candace Owens has said, how she's reacting to the what seems to be fairly strong, overwhelming evidence? What do you make of her, just her role, and what are you seeing there in particular?
If you're a podcaster and your business model is clickbait, that is, I got to get as many eyeballs on me as I can because that's how we sell ads, then the more outrageous you are, the more clicks you're going to get. But this is the idea that Tyler Robinson was programmed by the CIA or the Mossad or somebody to assassinate Charlie Kirk, even though he didn't even know what he was doing, and he was, you know, mindlessly assassinating him or something like that. Now, I don't know Candace Owens. I don't know Tucker Carlson. I don't know what's in their heart. But, you know, do they really believe the nonsense they're spouting? Maybe they're just making it up for clickbait. Or maybe they actually believe it. I don't know. You know, there is some research on this, research on deception and self-deception, that you're better at deceiving others if you believe the lie yourself, because you're more convincing. So it's possible that Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson have come to believe these stories they tell, in this particular case about Charlie Kirk. How anybody could say, well, that, you know, he was a patsy, I could tell you exactly where that comes from. You know, that very word comes from Lee Harvey Oswald famously saying, I was just a patsy. You know, in other words, he was part of this whole CIA program to mind control people. That's an older story. That's a real CIA program called MK Ultra, which was to not let the United States fall behind the mind control movement that was being spearheaded by the North Koreans, Chinese, and Russians. Again, back to my earlier point, you know, that the fact that somebody did something once, or, you know, way back in the 1950s or 60s, doesn't mean that every single thing that you think is happening today is also part of that.
Yeah. Okay, another theory you mentioned in your article is this idea that the killing was a false flag operation, an inside job, that it came from within the deep state. What are you hearing in this theory?
When you hear someone like Alex Jones, or in this case Candace Owens, or Tucker Carlson talking about, you know, it was a setup operation with some other motive. Okay, this also has a little element of truth to it. You know, back before the Cuban Missile Crisis with Kennedy and Castro and Cuba and all that stuff, there was a plan afoot by some of Kennedy's administration people to commit a false flag operation, like shoot down an American Airlines jet and blame it on the Cubans, and then we can invade. In other words, a false flag so that we can respond. And the Gulf of Tonkin might have been a false flag operation. That is, we're going to sink this American ship, and then the United States will respond to this act of aggression. Okay, so there's just enough element of truth to some of that to then say, this event I'm interested in this case, the shooting of Charlie Kirk, was a false flag operation. It was conducted in order to have some other excuse, in this case, you know, Israel and U.S. support for Israel and that sort of thing.
I think one of the most interesting theories here you mentioned is the fake death theory. The notion that Charlie Kirk faked his death and then retreated to a big spread in Montana. You want to mention this one?
Well, so my favorite, when I was researching my conspiracy book, my favorite paper I read was called Dead and Alive. And this is about the death of Princess Diana, that people who told pollsters they thought Princess Diana was murdered, not that she died, but was murdered, were also more likely to think she faked her death and she's still alive.
Yeah.
And people have faked their death. You know, again, the element of truth. There are people who fake their death, usually to get out of creditors coming after them, or ex-spouses or lawyers or whatever. That's the usual motive. But it has happened. So, you know, could Charlie Kirk still be alive? Really? The wife is going along with this? I mean, I will admit, you know, Erica Kirk's attitudes about this whole thing have been a little weird. But, you know, I've never had a spouse killed, so I don't know how you're supposed to act. But people assume, well, that's not how I would act. This is the point Candace Owen makes constantly. She's not acting like a grieving wife.
Yeah.
Well, how are grieving wives supposed to act? What's our database? What's the base rate here?
Right.
And, of course, nothing is ever provided.
What's the political ideology that's contributing to all of this? That is, what's the worldview of that's keeping people from just evaluating the evidence or information in a rationally objective way here? Is this an effect of the moment we're in now, or is it does this kind of thing happen all the time? This isn't actually terribly distinctive. This just happens.
It's not that distinct yet, but, you know, politics drives a lot of this. Whoever's in power, the people out of power think the people in power have more influence than they actually have, that they're up to no good. They're conspiring to do something. So when the Dems are in power, the Republicans tend to think, you know, Hillary's up to something or Obama's, you know, contriving to do this or whatever. It goes both ways. Trump is a little more divisive. Plus, social media has really taken off and become more divisive since, you know, Trump's first administration, 2016, he went. So, you know, that's kind of when the whole social media thing really got crazy online. So you have a combination of, you know, the Republicans are in power and the, you know, social media has gotten so divisive. So all, you know, everything that the person in power does is suspect. And that goes both ways. I mean, you know, you can say all you want about Biden being incompetent and old and infirm and so on, but that was never enough for the Republicans. You know, he's up to no good. You know, he's contriving, he's complotting, he's conspiring to do these things. Like, really, Joe Biden? How about just incompetence? We even have a phrase in conspiracy theories, you know, never attribute to malice what can be explained by incompetence or just randomness.
Right. So the evidence that's coming from the coverage of this preliminary hearing, for example, what seems to be pretty overwhelming evidence from multiple cameras on campus that indicate Tyler Robinson's presence and behavior on the UVU campus isn't, of course, going to be convincing for this person. Would it be right to say the evidence is actually creating a stronger commitment of these people to believe there's a larger conspiracy? Like you look at this evidence and it doesn't make you rethink. It just makes you double down like the UFO cult.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the case of the world didn't end, it couldn't be more obvious. But yeah. So you have to, when the evidence is overwhelming, you have to really double down as opposed to saying, you know what, I think I got this one wrong. Almost nobody says that, particularly if it's politically charged. I mean, in general, the more important the belief is to you, the less the evidence matters. Okay. So like, let's take a different case. Anthropogenic global warming. Is global warming real and human caused? Yes, it is. Okay. The number one predictor of who will believe it or not is political orientation. Conservatives tend to be skeptical of global warming. Liberals tend to believe it. Okay. Studies on climate deniers and, you know, who they are, what they know, and so on, versus climate believers, I accept it, shows neither one of them knows that much about it. And the believers in climate change, they don't actually know any more facts about it than the deniers. And nobody knows much about it at all. It's a technical science, right? So the point is that we're signaling our belief in something, not based on facts, based on political orientation or religious beliefs or whatever, what we want to be true. And that's the case across the board. Most people just say, I believe this or I don't believe that.
Let me ask you one final question, and I guess it is whether you worry about this. I mean, clearly, you're not surprised at of the theories that have come out of this already. But I guess, do these things have any actual effect on the process enough to make you at all concerned, or is this just one of the things you have to put up with in things like this?
Maybe. As worried as I am about all the craziness online, it isn't clear how influential it is. If it's influential, it's pretty small. I don't think it makes a huge difference. I think larger trends like left-wing or right-wing beliefs and ideologies are much more powerful than like Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson. But ultimately, you know, I mean, I think there's larger forces at work that maybe wash over a lot of the conspiracism.
Michael Shermer, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael Shermer. His article for the Free Press is called Why the Charlie Kirk Conspiracy Theories Will Never Die. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the first major court hearing in the case against Tyler Robinson. He's accused of killing Charlie Kirk. The judge has to decide if there's enough evidence for the case to go to trial, so we're talking about what the state revealed in a hearing last week and, of course, the first hints of the defense's strategy. Jessica Schreifels has been covering the case for the Salt Lake Tribune. We asked her to join us.
So last week was the preliminary hearing for Tyler Robinson, and it's a little bit like a trial. It kind of has that same format where there's witnesses and there's cross-examination, but the goal is for a judge to determine whether there's probable cause for the case to move forward. And this is kind of supposed to be like a safety net, right? Like in other states, there's maybe like a grand jury process, and we see indictments and that's cleared through these like grand jurors. In Utah, prosecutors kind of have the power to file charges as they want to.
Yeah.
And so having this preliminary hearing is supposed to be a way for a judge to look at just part of the evidence and then decide, okay, yeah, this can move forward, or like, no, this has no merit at all. We're just tossing it out. So that's kind of the intention of it. But it does kind of become a little bit trial-like, where there's some evidence, some testimony, but it's not a full-blown trial, and it doesn't have to be like evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. Judges looking for probable cause, basically, to say, all right, we can move forward for a trial. There's enough here.
Right, exactly. And the rules are a little bit different, and they have to, you know, look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution.
Yeah.
And so that's where you don't see a lot – you don't see the defense bringing a full case because the judge can't weigh the evidence. So it's a waste of everyone's time to have, you know, a defense bringing in their full case, and they probably don't want to show it publicly yet. So we see a lot of very heavy prosecution witnesses and not a lot of like what the defense will be doing.
I think this is such an important point to make for people to sort of remind them that people – and you're seeing a lot of this because this is very much an online sort of phenomenon. People are already drawing these big, broad conclusions from the smattering of evidence, even though it looks fairly extensive from the prosecution. But this isn't all they're going to present. And this is nothing or not much of what the defense is going to present. So drawing any large conclusions from this preliminary hearing doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah. It's hard to say, you know, with absolute certainty, like any conclusion, like you said, or, you know, maybe there is some DNA evidence, but at a trial, you might see like two or three DNA experts for either side say, yeah, well, this DNA isn't as strong, or there's other DNA there also, you know, so that we don't see the evidence being tested with the same like rigor that you might see at a trial.
I suppose what the hearing did show us is that it gives us some sense of the case the state has against Tyler Robinson. And I guess how strong the case is, at least we do have some sense that there's extensive evidence here. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there is pretty compelling evidence that Tyler Robinson had been on and off campus that day several times. He allegedly confessed in many places, you know, in text messages to his partner, in a written note to his partner,
yeah,
in Discord chats. You know, they showed a lot of that evidence of times that he had purportedly confessed. And then there is some DNA evidence that – or likely DNA evidence that is linking him. So the case so far is pretty compelling or pretty strong. I would imagine that the judge would likely find probable cause just because of how low that bar is.
Yeah. Which made me wonder – why did this have to take a week? Why did there have to be so much evidence that the prosecution presented? Is there any sense of why that would be? Because it would seem fairly clear to the judge fairly early on in the process that there was enough here to then move forward and just sort of close the door on this process and move forward to a trial. But any sense of that?
I think there were also times last week where I said, why is this taking a week? Like,
yeah,
it did feel very,
yeah,
long. And I think that, you know, I've covered a lot of preliminary hearings that are 20 minutes long. You know, they're very, very fast.
Right.
And so I think why this took so much time was, well, one, the defense pushed back a lot more than what you typically see. You hardly ever see, like, defense expert witnesses testifying in a preliminary hearing, and they had, I think, three.
Yeah.
So that took some time. They fought a lot about access. There was a lot of arguments about what evidence could be shown,
right,
and whether it's just the courtroom or published on a live stream, or can a media camera be there. So there's a lot about that. But I think, too, it wasn't so cut and dry where one piece of evidence showed probable cause. I think you had to kind of have the DNA with the notes, with the surveillance video to kind of like build that case a little bit more.
Hmm. How do you describe the atmospherics going on down there in Utah County? I guess you could describe it as the spectacle. Do you get a sense of the kind of national or maybe even international attention this is getting?
Yeah, it was a chaotic week last week. I mean, you had all of the security at this courthouse has been really tight at every hearing, but especially for this one, you couldn't even be on like the floor of the hearing if you didn't have like a wristband or whatever. So the security was tight. Tyler Robinson's being brought in and out in like an armored vehicle. You've got like every TV station, Fox News, you know, all of them are lined up doing their live hits all day long. And then all of us media also. But then you also had people who either just wanted to, like, they love true crime and they love to like sit in courtrooms, who wanted to come and be there. And then towards the end of the week, we got a lot more of like podcasters and like people who supported Charlie Kirk. And so it seemed like every day it got like a tiny bit more like a circus. And, you know, there was limited seating and there was, I think, 14 public seats. And by the end of the week, people were lining up at 6 p.m. the night before to try to get a seat for the next day. And so it was just really quite a different atmosphere than any case I've covered so far in Utah. It was a little bit of a circus for sure.
As you said, the hearing was live streamed. Have you paid attention to the kind of coverage? I mean, we're getting a lot of this is the era we're in now, right?
Yeah.
So like the social media influencers are they're breaking down every last second of it. This is live coverage. It's incredible, it seems.
Yeah, and it's so interesting so the judge wouldn't allow anyone to have electronics in the courtroom. So when you go in there, you've got a pen and paper and you come out 8 hours later. And you're like, what's happened in the world since I've been in there? So a lot of it I didn't see because I was in the courtroom, but it was interesting. You know, I'd look at my phone at the end of the day and see all these social media videos. And there was even things that people cued in on that I didn't notice when I was sitting there live watching it, right? Like there's a moment where the judge was watching a video of the shooting and he hadn't played that through the courtroom because he didn't want that graphic video being played. And I think I probably was looking at Tyler Robinson or maybe Erica Kirk or somebody else, and it didn't dawn on or didn't see the judge like visibly like react.
Flinched.
He flinched. And I saw that later on social media, and I was like in the room that day. And so it is interesting to see like how like the details you can pick apart when you can like stop and play and rewind and pick your clip.
Yeah. So Charlie Kirk's parents and his widow, Erica Kirk, they were there. Important for them to be there. I guess not necessary, but the fact that they were there for a preliminary hearing seemed to say something. I think they said that they were there as this, what did they describe, a unified support system or something like that. What effect did that have on the hearing itself, as far as you could tell?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, so in Utah, we do have like victims' rights like written into our state constitution. And so like when the judge is making these decisions about what to show or what not to show, he has to weigh Tyler Robinson's right to a fair trial with victims' rights. And so we saw that at play in this hearing more so than any others that we've had so far, where, you know, they were very insistent that everything be shown. They wanted total transparency. But it was also, you could tell, very emotional for them. There were any time there was discussion about, you know, the moment of the shooting itself, they got up and like left the courtroom. They just did not want to be there for any discussion of like the actual moment that shot was fired. So it was definitely like a challenging, and it did seem at sometimes like a bit frustrating for them that they wanted like everything to be shown because there's so many conspiracy theories out there and, you know, some of them implicating Erica. And so I think it was so important for them that they wanted no room for like, or they wanted, you know, they wanted to be clear, this is the evidence and we're not hiding anything.
Right. There's a statement made by Jeff Niemann. He's an attorney for the family. And he said in this, I'm reading, this is from your coverage, Jessica, that in the absence of transparency, speculation and conspiracy theories related to the tragic assassination of Mr. Kirk will continue to proliferate in the public domain, breeding doubt and distrust in the judicial system. So they really want to be clear about that and careful.
Right. And I think you, like, one example I think of is there's, you know, a conspiracy theory that he wasn't shot, but that like a microphone or something had exploded like at his lapel.
Yeah.
And there was an autopsy report that was discussed.
Yeah.
And but the judge wouldn't publish that because he felt that it was an invasion of, you know, Charlie Kirk's right to privacy, dignity, whatever. And so, you know, if the whole world could have seen the actual document that said that he had a, you know, a bullet shot through his neck,
right,
perhaps that could have stopped that conspiracy theory. But though it was said that that's what the report said, it wasn't actually shown. So I think it was like those type of things that were frustrating to the family, that they wanted, like, they wanted people to see with their own eyes, like, what this report says and look at it. And the judge didn't let that happen in some cases.
It's so interesting because he's trying – it seems like he's trying to balance what he said was a respect for the – he said the family deserved respect and dignity. And yet you're hearing from the family itself saying it's got to be out there.
Right.
So how does he manage that? In the end, he allowed it to be shown – but it seems like a delicate balancing act for him. Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you've got Tyler Robinson's right to a fair trial. You've
right.
got victims' rights.
Right.
And you've got, like, media attorneys, right? Like, we're all, like, transparency. You
yes,
know,
yes,
the
yes.
Media
we should,
is and there as well.
We should
know?
Mention this. The Tribune and other media outlets were making the argument.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, there's so many different people who have, like, all – so you're trying to thread this needle of being transparent and have, like, you know, access to the courts and everything while – you know, it's interesting to me with this judge. He doesn't often rule like off the cuff on like large decisions. Mm. Everything is in writing. Everything is done very carefully, mm. because I, you know, they've said more than once, we only want to do this once. Like
right.
this is obviously going to be appealed. I think it's already been appealed like three times. It hasn't gone anywhere. But you know, like this is a case that the appeals are going to be done at almost every single step. And
yeah.
so I think he's trying to have as much transparency as possible and have like respect Erica Kirk as a victim representative, but at the end of the day, the person sitting in the defendant's chair like has a right to a fair trial, and that's also in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So he's just balancing so many different things.
What else can you tell us about this judge, Tony Graff?
So he's actually really new to the bench. I think he was sworn in like 25 days before he got this assignment or got
wow.
assigned this case. So he's like brand new on
wow.
the bench. And yeah, it's been interesting to watch him. He's very careful. He, like I said, he does not make rulings off the cuff. He doesn't often, like, he'll take arguments under advisement, and then, like, 2 weeks later we go on a WebEx hearing, and then he reads his decision.
Hmm.
And so it's interesting that with how careful he's been, and he made this really interesting speech. I think it was Tyler Robinson's first court appearance, which is judges usually don't make speeches in a case. But, you know, he talked about how he was going to ensure that this process was fair for everybody.
Mm.
And I think that's the way he's trying to look at it. He's very thoughtful, but also knows he obviously has a lot of eyes on him. So he's being very, very careful.
It's a weird question, but does he have a sense of the cameras being present? Does he have a kind of charisma? Is he retiring? Is he outspoken? Like, what's this kind of presence at this stage?
Yeah, I thought that speech at first, I was like, oh, that's unusual. And there was definitely some cameras there. So
yeah,
I was
yeah.
wondering if that might have prompted it. But, you know, it's interesting. He's really clamped down on the cameras and where they can be. There's only one in the very back of video, and a photographer is also in the gallery. So compared to some other like trials that we've covered, the cameras don't feel as present. You know, it
yeah.
doesn't feel like you're being live streamed, and he's not as like grandstanding or like grandiose as you might think if you were like leading a live stream courtroom.
Yeah. Jessica Schreifels, she's an investigative reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find a link to her coverage on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're looking at the first major court hearing in the case against Tyler Robinson. He's the 23-year-old accused of killing Charlie Kirk. Last week's preliminary hearing wasn't a trial. It was about whether prosecutors have presented enough evidence for the case to move forward. And so over 5 days, the hearing offered the clearest picture yet of the case that prosecutors are building and some early indications of how the defense is going to try to challenge it. To help us sort through what we learned, we spoke with the Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Schreifels. Give us a sense of what we're learning about what the state, the prosecution, is going to be saying about Tyler Robinson's coming and going on the day of the shooting, but the day before, because it began on the 10th of September, his presence on the campus, or allegedly. What are we seeing about that? Because there's these days there are cameras everywhere, and I guess there is a kind of a trajectory or a path that the state says you can follow.
Yeah, and this was definitely a reminder that there are cameras everywhere. Yeah. You know, you could see. So the shooting was on September 10th. So he came on campus like early that morning at 8 in the morning. Again, you can see his like kind of distinct car. You see him walking around in like shorts and a T-shirt. I think he leaves. Then he comes back again, goes to Chick-fil-A on campus, eats lunch. And then he comes back, I think, the third time. And by this time, he had like changed clothes and was wearing pants and had like a limp, which the insinuation is that the rifle that he used was in his pants. And so you can see that. You can see him. He looks a little less identifiable than the early videos. He's got hat on, sunglasses on. But you see him walking up and down, which were those still shots when they were looking for somebody. That's where those came from.
Right.
And then you see a very wide shot, and it's just a person. I don't know if anyone could really say with certainty that it's him.
Yeah.
Going up to this rooftop, running across the edge, lying down at around the same time the shooting happened, and then running off, jumping off the building and running into these like wooded area, which is where the rifle was found and things like that. And so I think there, and then there was another time later that night where he had come back like into the early morning hours of the next day. So they could see that he had come and gone off the campus, or who they believe was him,
right,
coming and going like four times that day.
And I guess this is where the state, in presenting this particular video evidence, they didn't just show this unexpurgated, unedited thing. They charted it up. Zoomed in. They circled different things, and the judge wasn't having that.
Yeah, they try. Yeah, so like when you watch it, because we did watch the unedited one, and it's hard to see anything that's happening. It's the shot is so wide. I think I saw like one little body like jumping off the building. Like you just don't see the context. And so why they were trying to edit it, I feel like is a little bit understandable, because it is hard to see what's going on. But it was surprising to me that they tried to have like edited footage admitted as evidence. And so the judge was like, no, we're not doing that. You can't alter the evidence.
Yeah.
So we eventually saw the unedited footage, which again was like very challenging to see. But then the Kirk family attorney did ask again, hey, it was really hard for them to see and understand this. Can you please show the edited one to everybody? So they didn't show it on the live stream, but they showed it to those of us that were in the courtroom. So now we've seen both. But yeah, they were zooming in and like circling, like here's the person as like running across the roof.
How much clarity is there? I mean, I think when you look at the online discussion going on, and it's all over the place, especially those who are convinced that there's a larger conspiracy at play, and that it wasn't that as Candace Owens had said, for example, as she's very prominent in this debate, obviously, saying that he wasn't even on campus, or at least for a time she said that. Anyway, there was some question about whether or not that was even him. So I guess this is the question: is there a lot of clarity there? Does it seem to be Tyler Robinson?
I mean, like I said, I think the first video you saw, you can see his face and you're like, well, that looks pretty much the same as this guy in the courtroom. Yeah. And then the next one with like the hat on, you're like, well, and once you kind of see the first one, is it affecting your memory, you know, of the next person you're seeing? But, you know, it still looks quite like him. I think when they are asserting that person who ran across the rooftop was him, like there's no way. There's no defining features. You can't see who the face is. Obviously, this is perhaps why this took so long, you know, because they're taking that and then adding on, and this rifle was found in the woods, and this rifle likely has his DNA on it. So it's like they're piecing it together. But some of that surveillance evidence, I would say, was not as strong. You can't see the face of the person who was crawling on that rooftop.
Tyler Robinson's defense team didn't want the public to see these video clips. Let's talk about why it is. Defense attorney Kathy Nestor, she was saying, look, if you show this footage, it's going to play a really big role in the trial. And I guess what she meant by that was, we don't have a jury yet. So everyone who's seeing this or hearing about this trajectory that you that they've laid out, these are all potential jurors. Is that the basic argument?
Right, exactly. And, you know, everyone has a constitutional right to a fair trial. Yeah. And so they are constantly hammering that, you know, any release of information will be a violation of that right. And even to the point they wanted the entire preliminary hearing closed, which was just a really kind of novel. I mean, almost every filing they filed these days, they file it under seal and then, you know, we have to argue to get it unsealed. Mm-hmm. And so they are really trying to say, you know, every single part of this process should be behind closed doors because of his right to a fair trial. But the judge really has not entertained that so far. I mean, courtrooms have always been open and they're always open to the public. And I have been a little bit surprised that he is still allowing a live stream. I think you could maybe tamp down some of the information if it wasn't broadcast. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't done that yet. And so there's been times where certain pieces of evidence he won't publish to, like, the cameras. Like, for instance, like, a video of the actual shooting itself, right, just because of how graphic that was. Right, right. The autopsy report. There was portions of an interview that Tyler Robinson's roommate and romantic partner did where the judge said, oh, some of these aren't relevant or it's repetitive, so cut out from here to here and here to here. Hmm. So he kind of culled the evidence or, you know, for what he wanted the public to be able to see and maybe kept the more sensitive stuff behind closed doors.
But who's this for? Is it for the judge? Because basically, this is for the judge.
Yeah.
The judge just – so why does he care what the public can see or can't see? He can see it. All he is ruling is whether there's probable cause to move forward with this trial. And so it does raise the question – and I know that's ironic as a journalist saying that. I'm not arguing against this information, but I do think it's a reasonable question to say – to ask how much evidence can or should a court allow at this point in the process. The idea that a jury pool is being influenced – doesn't seem that unreasonable.
Right. I mean, and he sees all this evidence, right? Yeah. Even the stuff that he's not publishing, he's looking at. Yeah. So he's watching all of it. I think this is just such an unusual amount of publicity. Generally, you know, most people, if they have a preliminary hearing, no one ever sees it, right? Normal people who go through this process, or maybe one or two journalists are there who write a print article. This is just a crazy amount of publicity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I think he has to think about Tyler Robinson's right to a fair trial, which is why he's trying to weigh this.
Right.
And so I think that's what he's thinking about when he makes these decisions, even though they're a little bit confusing sometimes.
He's just aware of the, international attention on this, and he wants to be super careful,
exactly.
I guess. So do you have a sense of what the defense is going to be arguing? I mean, clearly they're pushing back against the case that the state has been making, to some degree anyway. But is there any clarity about the argument that they're going to be making?
Yeah. And, you know, this is not – like I mentioned earlier, this isn't like the venue to have a full defense.
Right.
And so you're trying to like read the tea leaves in the way that you're asking questions. And so, you know, they push back a lot on – some of the DNA evidence that it was not maybe as 100% confirmation, because you could never 100% say that there's like a DNA match.
This took up several hours.
It did. And so they push back on things like that. I would suspect they probably make an argument that even if there was like a murder, that this is not an aggravated murder, which is different, right? Like in order to get the death penalty, you have to do murder in a really bad way. You know, you have to like torture somebody or have more than one victim or, you know, do other crime when this is happening. Mm. And I think that it's been a while since I've looked at the charging documents, but I think here they're alleging that other people were in danger.
Right.
And so I noticed there was a line of questioning where they were asking, like, was there anyone behind Charlie Kirk, like in that tent area where he was sitting under? And so I'm not sure if they're just going to challenge just getting like the aggravated murder off the table, and if it's just murder, then they can't seek the death penalty. So I could maybe see an argument that way, but we haven't seen, you know, any sweeping assertions that he wasn't there or that he didn't leave these notes, or we haven't seen like that yet.
Judge Graf asked during this process this question, does religion or gender intersect with politics? And this question of Charlie Kirk's faith and his opinions, what was happening there? What was that about?
Yeah, so the prosecutors charged what's called like it's like a victim enhancement. Like you've selected your victim for a certain reason. Maybe their race, their gender, yeah. their religion, whatnot.
It's kind of like a hate crime justification.
Yeah, and so here they were saying that Tyler Robinson chose him because of his political beliefs. It's honestly a really fascinating argument for a couple of hours, which isn't always the case in these hearings, but it was really interesting to just, yeah, it almost became a philosophical debate of can your political beliefs be your religious beliefs? Are they so intertwined?
Is there a political angle to this in the sense that this story played out in just a hyper-partisan climate? And so you had people on the right of a very particular, you know, sort of point of view. And we'll just say also, well, I won't put him just on the right, but the governor, Republican mm-hmm. conservative governor, being quite adamant that they were going to seek the death penalty. Kash Patel's interesting presence, mm-hmm. I'll put it that way, during all of this, the interest of the president of the United States and in certainly Charlie Kirk in the case itself, all of that. Is there do you sense that there's – how much attention is the governor paying to this, for example, at this point, if you can tell? And is there any of that that you can sense at this point?
I think it's interesting because I think what we saw like actually playing out in the courtroom was pretty restrained, right? Like the only mentions of it might be like – the FBI, like, DNA person saying, I was told to, like, rush this. You know, you'd hear things like that. But the politics part of it or the interest didn't really come into the case itself. But I think you go like, you know, behind the bar and there's Donald Trump Jr. there with his wife. And right. Mike Lee is there. Yeah. And then they go out afterwards and, like, Trump goes on Fox News or, like, Mike Lee does a live or whatever on his X account. And so we did kind of see, I think, a rallying around the Kirks or trying to like tamp down the conspiracy theories by people that they had invited to come to the courtroom. And then they spoke about it afterwards. The Kirks were very restrained in not commenting on the evidence. Yeah. But that definitely can't be said for everyone. A lot of people went and did like kind of little media tours after they were in the courtroom.
Do you think we learned anything new, anything we didn't already know? And I don't just mean about the evidence, but about the way this case is going to be presented or play out, anything at all, do you think?
It was interesting that the charging information was already incredibly detailed. It's an unusual amount of detail to put in a charging information, you know, like quotes of text back and forth.
Right.
So a lot of it we did already see laid out, but it was different to watch it, right, to look at the bullet casings that he allegedly engraved. Mm-hmm. So look at the text messages that are being sent. So I don't know if we learned like a new bombshell thing, right. But you got like the context or, you know, some people would say like those text messages aren't real. That's not how like people talk to each other.
Yeah.
And then you can see the photos and you can like see it. And so I think that just seeing the evidence might make a difference in some way.
Do we know whether or not Tyler Robinson's going to plead guilty and whether the case is going to go that way to more extenuating circumstances, to take the charge lower, present a case of mental illness or something like – I mean, is it way too early to know exactly how the defense is going to ultimately treat this?
Yeah, I definitely think it's pretty early, right? Yeah. They haven't raised any of these issues, like you say, like about mental illness or things like that. They keep talking about a trial, yeah. right? We got to get a jury pool that's not tainted. And so – but everyone kind of says that at this point. So I think it's just way too early to tell. I mean, we haven't had a death penalty trial conviction since like 2008. So it's very unlikely that a death penalty case – in modern time actually goes forward in Utah. Mm. But this could be the exception. I mean, this is obviously an extraordinary different case than the run-of-the-mill aggravated homicide.
But say what you mean by that. I think I know what you mean by that, just because of the high-profile nature of it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think nothing has been typical about this case so right. far. Everything takes so long. Everything is being done. Like, even like the funding for it, right? So Tyler Robinson has a public defender, and or four public defenders, and I've compared the contract with him at another Utah County death penalty case, and these attorneys are getting paid much more than other death, like current death penalty cases in the same county. And when I asked the county about that, they said, well, this is just different. This is like a higher profile case. So everyone kind of recognizes it has that like different feel to it, that it feels so weighty because everyone's watching it.
What's next?
So what's next, that I'll come back in September and argue some more. And the judge will then decide if there's probable cause for the case to move forward. So after that happens, that's when he enters a plea. And then that's where we kind of start seeing the move towards trial if he pleads not guilty. This is when they start fighting about, like, what evidence can the jury see? What experts are qualified to come and be on the stand? So then they fight about that for a long time until the trial. And who knows when that will be. Probably a long way away.
Yeah. So I guess what you're saying is we have months for people to sort of stew on what came last week.
Exactly, yes.
Jessica, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jessica Schreifels, she's an investigative reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll put a link to her coverage on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.